This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, some major defections in the Republican Party as the country gears up for the general election. But does it really matter, or is this just trumped up ado about nothing? Brendan James from the International Business Times comes on to discuss.
Then the FBI continues its push to broaden its surveillance powers after the Orlando attack, but a certain senator from Oregon is making things difficult for the feds.
And finally, a major legal assault on labor unions has finally been put to bed. We explain in today's People's Bulletin.
But first, it was Joseph de Maistre who originally said, "Every nation gets the government it deserves." And today, Sam, that quote has me wondering what exactly we as a nation did to deserve this upcoming presidential election.
Well, Sam, first there was the Iraq War.
Yeah,
that,
true.
That was pretty bad. The worldwide financial crisis in 2008.
Yeah, that was kind of bad, too.
That was kind of a lot of our fault. I don't know. Maybe we've been due a kick in the rear for a long time for those.
Yeah, maybe you're right. And a kick in the rear is exactly what we are getting. As you might have been informed over the last few weeks since Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton became their respective parties' presumptive nominees, we're on the verge of perhaps the most unpopular election in modern history. According to a Real Clear Politics poll average, Trump has an unfavorable rating of 65%. Clinton has an unfavorable rating of 55%. Now, those are the two highest unfavorable ratings ever recorded for a major party's presidential nominee. Mind you, the person running against Clinton, Bernie Sanders, had one of the highest approval ratings, favorable ratings, of any candidate.
Yeah, he's also, I believe, still the most popular senator in the United States Senate based on the approval rating of his constituents.
Yes, and one thing we saw with Sanders is as people got to know him more, his favorability only went up. It seems to be the opposite with the two candidates. But hey, we're not complaining here. We're not sour grapes about the primary.
Yeah, maybe a little bit.
Okay, we are a little bit.
Definitely.
So yeah, we've got the two most unpopular candidates ever. And I want to be careful off the bat not to draw a false equivalency here. Trump is way worse than Clinton. Mm. He's essentially scum.
Yeah.
And the only barely justifiable reason for supporting him would be to heighten the contradictions in hopes of collapsing the U.S. government and installing a much more progressive, better system in its place.
But that doesn't work. Ronald Reagan, for example, was followed by George H.W. Bush.
Yeah.
And the Clinton, the new Democrats, Clinton's basically, Bill Clinton accepting the Reagan consensus or whatever.
So true. And
that didn't work then.
Around the world, history has given us examples of chaos created, and usually it's the fascist who takes over in that mess. But look, none of this works. So even that sort of reason to support Trump, to heighten the contradictions, that should be questioned. Clinton would obviously be a better U.S. president than Trump, and that's pretty much without a doubt. But saying that someone would be better than Trump ain't saying much. If you're better than the Donald, it's possible that you're still pretty darn bad. And that is the case with the Democrats' nominee this year. Just this week, a few stories have come out showing that Clinton still doesn't get it. That on far too many issues, from climate change to student debt, Clinton shies away from the sort of bold revolutionary reform that people are demanding. And instead, her and her allies fall back on the incrementalist, market-based reforms that come to define the neoliberal movement and have helped create much of the economic mess that the country finds itself in today.
Well, at least when she says she gets things done, she's not joking.
No.
Not on that front.
That's true. Neither was her husband, who got quite a lot of things done in the 90s, and most of those things were pretty bad. I'm thinking the crime bill,
financial deregulation.
Don't ask, don't tell.
Free trade with,
NAFTA,
the permanent trade relations with China. There were the constant bombing campaigns of Iraq,
yes,
as enforcing brutal sanctions that hurt hundreds of millions of people.
Right. So yeah, when the Clintons get things done, that's not necessarily a good thing. But fast forward to today. Let's take climate change, for example. As we talked about on the show yesterday, Dems approved of their draft platform over the weekend, which includes some good things, but it falls short in a number of areas. Climate change activist Bill McKibben, who was appointed to sit on the platform drafting committee by Bernie Sanders, he released a statement over the weekend explaining how the Clinton campaign sabotaged efforts that would actually slow the warming of the planet. And I just want to read you a little bit of what McKibben said right here. Quote, "We all agreed that America should be operating on 100% clean energy by 2050. But then I proposed in one amendment after another a series of ways we might actually get there." And then McKibben goes on to explain all his proposals. A carbon tax? Voted down 7-6. A ban on fracking? Voted down 7-6. An effort to keep fossil fuels in the ground, at least on federal land? Voted down 7-6.
I'm noticing a pattern here.
Yes. A measure to mandate that federal agencies weigh the climate impact of their decisions. What do you think that was voted down, Sam?
Going to take a total shot in the dark here and guess 7-6.
You nailed it.
Yes.
Even a plan to keep fossil fuel companies from taking private land by eminent domain. That was voted down.
8-5?
Try it again.
7-6?
Nailed it.
Yes.
McKibben notes that the platform writing committee did, however, reach unanimous consent on more bike paths.
Hey.
So that's good. He goes on to say, McKibben goes on to say, in other words, the Clinton campaign is at this point rhetorically committed to taking on our worst problems, but not willing to say how, which is the slightly cynical way politicians have addressed issues for too long and just the kind of slickness that the straightforward Sanders campaign rejected.
I mean, at least with the bike path stuff, right? If you happen to live near a coastal area that's being flooded by rising sea levels, at least with the bike paths, you won't need a car to escape the slowly rising waters there.
Okay, but how is a bike going to escape the slowly rising waters?
There's a bike path. You just assume that the bike paths lead
is on high ground
away from the ocean. I don't
know. Fair enough. On another issue here, Clinton, she was pretty straightforward on Tuesday in releasing a tech and innovation plan that will give student debt relief to only a small class of individuals. According to her campaign, quote, Hillary will allow entrepreneurs to put their federal student loans into a special status while they get their new ventures off the ground. For millions of young Americans, this would mean deferment from having to make any payments on their student loans for up to 3 years, zero interest and zero principal, as they work through the critical startup phase of new enterprises. We've got a student loan debt crisis in this country where student loan debt outweighs credit card debt, automobile debt. There's millions of students in debt, and Clinton just wants to give relief to the small fraction of them who are going to go off and start a business.
Hey, I mean, America could always use more app makers, right?
Yeah. Well, what about the artists? Do they not get student debt relief? What about writers? What about journalists? I don't know. What about graduates who can only find work in low-wage jobs? We know what this economy provides right now. Only entrepreneurs? Sounds like Clinton only wants to give Trump's kids student loan relief.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty rich. Obviously a reference, of course, to when Clinton said she opposed free public tuition, which is backed by Sanders, Bernie Sanders, because she didn't want to pay for Donald Trump's kids' schools. I mean, that's pretty weak. That's pretty cynical, if you ask me. It's a pretty cynical attack on, you know, universal access to things.
Right.
I mean, we're paying for Donald Trump's kids' highways, their Social Security and Medicare. I mean, you know, what argument couldn't you use that for any kind of public good?
Well, what she does with that argument is she says that higher education is not a basic human right, that she wants to turn it into a welfare program.
That it's more fit for people like Donald Trump's kids, and it'll stay that way.
Agreed. There's more to go here with Clinton this week. The conservative group Judicial Watch, which is actually a kind of bad organization, but has done fairly decent work in kind of discovering some stuff about the NSA surveillance programs. Anyways, the group released a new batch of Clinton emails that reportedly show the former Secretary of State attempting to get former Prime Minister Tony Blair a job. Former UK Prime Minister. Blair, of course, the leader who assisted George W. Bush and lied his country into an illegal war, too.
By the way, I thought I'd mention this because we've been talking about this in past shows. You mentioned Tony Blair. I just wanted to let our listeners know, if they're not aware, that This week, Jeremy Corbyn did not survive a confidence vote in the Labour Party. I just thought I'd throw that out there.
And he basically told the Labour Party to screw off. He's staying
He's staying. And he's basically the anti-Tony Blair. To give our listeners some context.
Same party, but complete opposite. Then there's TPP. Sure, Clinton came out opposed to the trade deal on the campaign trail, yet her appointees to the Dem Platform Writing Committee helped block amendments that would have enshrined opposition to the TPP in the party's platform. Why? Why are Clinton's team opposed to this if they really are against the TPP? This has created an opening that Donald Trump can exploit. And as bad as he is, he actually looks like he knows what he's talking about when he warns that Clinton will likely flip-flop once again on TPP, as he did during a speech on Tuesday.
But have no doubt that she will immediately approve it if it's put before her. And that is guaranteed. Guaranteed. Here's how it would go. She would make a small token change, declare the TPP pact fixed, and ram it through, and you will suffer. That's why Hillary is now only saying she has problems with TPP in its current form. You know what that means. That means, like, they'll make a little two-word change, and she'll fix it, and she'll feel great. But she says in its current form. She can rush to embrace it again, and she will at the earliest opportunity.
You know, I think we were making similar points earlier this week.
As Donald Trump?
Yeah, but he's still terrible.
Right. You know what they say about broken clocks.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I said at the onset of the show, despite his opposition to TPP, Trump is even worse than Clinton. Putting aside the stuff he's actually said, that's awful, you know, from the wall to the Muslim ban to expanding libel laws to go after journalists. It's clear Trump is a disaster. Put it in the language that Beltway reporters can understand. He's a dumpster fire or a drumpster fire or whatever.
I don't know. Watch Game of Thrones. You can make one of those stupid references.
Yes. Donald Trump is Joffrey and Bernie Sanders is the High Sparrow, according to at least 12 different Beltway journalists who've written the same exact article over the last year. Anyways, speaking of Trump, a USA Today investigation earlier this month revealed that Trump just doesn't pay his bills to people who do work for him. USA Today analysis found he has been involved in more than 3,500 lawsuits over the past three decades, and a large number of those involve ordinary Americans who say Trump or his companies have refused to pay them. Among the hundreds of people who claim Trump refused to pay them, a dishwasher in Florida, a glass company in New Jersey, a carpet company, a plumber, painters, 48 waiters, dozens of bartenders and other hourly workers at his resorts and clubs, coast to coast, real estate brokers who sold his properties, and law firms that once represented him in other lawsuits. Trump talks about how he's going to take on the elitist and the big guys in the establishment. Here he is suing plumbers and painters and making sure he doesn't pay them.
And also, how do you not pay your lawyers? I mean, you know they can sue you.
Yeah.
You know they don't. Anyway.
He just hires new lawyers to defend him from his old lawyers. Trump's companies have also been cited for 24 violations of the Fair Labor Standards Act since 2005 for failing to pay overtime or minimum wage, according to U.S. Department of Labor data. Then this week, there was an investigation by the Washington Post, which revealed that Donald Trump isn't nearly as charitable as he claims to be. Putting aside the millions of dollars he gave to veterans this year and what was mostly a political stunt, Trump has barely registered any charitable giving over the last 10 years. According to the Washington Post, they contacted 167 charities searching for evidence of personal gifts from Trump in the period between 2008 and this May. The Post sought out charities that had some link to Trump, either because he had given them his foundation's money, appeared at their charity galas, or praised them publicly. And what did the Washington Post find? Well, their search turned up just one donation in that entire period, a 2009 gift of between $5,000 and $10,000 to the Police Athletic League of New York City.
God, of course it was to the NYPD.
Yeah, it was
God,
to the police.
Of course it is.
This doesn't jive with what Trump has said about his philanthropy in the past. Trump promised to donate earnings from a wide variety of his money-making enterprises, the Post notes. That includes The Apprentice, his TV show, Trump Vodka, Trump University, a book, actually two books he wrote. The Post says if he honored all of those pledges, Trump's gift to charity would have topped $8.5 million. Instead, it was less than $10,000. So I ask again, Sam, what did we do to deserve these two candidates?
What did you and I do, or what did we...
I guess, what did our country do? I guess it has to do, you know, we've got bad voter laws. We had a primary system that left a lot of people out on the Democratic side. And we have bad media that doesn't seem to articulate what the important issues are or call out Trump when he's full of crap. So here we have these candidates. This could be a year for third-party candidates to make some noise. In a recent NBC News poll, Clinton gets the support from 39% of voters. Trump gets 38%. Johnson, though, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian nominee, gets 10%. And Jill Stein, the Green Party nominee, gets 6%. Speaking of Gary Johnson, he tweeted out some airline troubles he had on Monday night. He tweeted, quote, American Airlines batting 1,000% this trip. Lost luggage, not a flight on time. Getting home 6 hours late, hashtag my favorite airline.
So Gary Johnson is winning 10% of the presidential vote, and a commercial airline just lost his bags.
Yes, quite a contrast in his run for the president versus the two major parties. I don't understand. Maybe he should get Secret Service. We had Ben Carson during the primary getting Secret Service protection. Makes no sense to me. Anyway, more dissent coming up after the break. Unanimous dissent still here with you from Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Now, if any of you happen to be on Twitter, and I'm sure a lot of you are, you know that the Never Trump movement is something of a joke. While Trump himself is definitely also that, a joke, as we've gone on in the show to describe at length, the Never Trumpers mostly consist of neoconservative, serial careerists, and people who are, you know, on the same spectrum as Trump, racist, sexist, authoritarian, and awful. They just use polished language. Think Bill Kristol, Eric Erickson, Ben Shapiro, basically the biggest weenies on the internet. But will they have an impact on proceedings as we pivot to the general election?
In the past week, the Never Trump movement has gained two high-profile figures, longtime conservative columnist George Will, and Hank Paulson, former Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush from 2006 until the end of Bush's second term, a time that includes the start of the 2008 financial crisis. Will said he was leaving the party altogether, while Paulson said he'd be voting for the Democratic Party's nominee.
In a Washington Post op-ed, the former Treasury Secretary said the following, "When it comes to the presidency, I will not vote for Donald Trump. I will not cast a write-in vote. I'll be voting for Hillary Clinton with the hope that she can bring Americans together to do the things necessary to strengthen our economy, our environment, and our place in the world. To my Republican friends, I know I'm not alone," end of quote. Joining us now to talk about this development is Brendan James, International Business Times reporter. He's in New York, joining us by phone. Brendan, thanks for being on.
Hi, Sam, and hi, Sam.
Thank you for saying hi to both Sams here. So, can you explain to our listeners what the deal is? Why is George Will dropping his party affiliation, and why is Hank Paulson going full turncoat here?
Well, in the case of Will, who came out on Saturday at some speech he was giving, I believe it was to the Federalist Society, He was giving a speech and said, you know, I think with some sort of casual passing comment that he was going to leave the Republican Party outright. And he said that Paul Ryan's decision to embrace Trump was the catalyst for this decision. And Will identifies as a libertarian. I'm sure you could interrogate that position through different stances he's taken over the years.
Right, but he does identify as a libertarian.
He identifies as a libertarian, and so it's not hard to imagine him making the case that Trump, you know, is not a perfect reflection of a small government and free market enthusiast, because if he was, he'd be supporting a lot of other things that even some Democrats support with regard to the economy and free trade and things like that. And so Will, as so far as he still matters, made a lot of headlines about having just flat out given up on the Republicans. Now, Hank Paulson, as you mentioned, former Bush Treasury Secretary, he didn't outright leave the party, but penned a Washington Post op-ed emphatically endorsing Clinton over Trump. And we can talk about a lot of stuff here, but basically he said that Trump was, cosmetically unattractive, mostly he was going on about Trump's rejection of, you know, slashing the welfare state and embracing more free trade agreements internationally.
And he didn't at all mention Trump's proposed Muslim ban, did he?
I don't believe he did. I think he makes references to Trump. I've got the op-ed in front of me, and he makes references to his behavior and how he's strident. But I do not believe the Muslim ban comes up at all in this op-ed. He does say something about walling ourselves off from 7 billion people in the markets they represent. But that's really the most he goes to talking about, like, any kind of, you know, solidarity or something with, like, other humans on the planet.
This is Hank Paulson's take that the Muslim ban is bad solely because that disqualifies 1.7 billion potential consumers and tourists from coming to the United States. That is the only reason for Hank Paulson why the Muslim. No, I'm kidding.
Well, we don't know. I mean, he didn't go to the lengths to explain it to us. He didn't choose to make that argument.
Well, I think that speaks to the point that a lot of conservatives just know how to disguise their racism and xenophobia a lot better than Trump. They don't necessarily oppose him on the wall or the Muslim ban. They just, you know, resent how openly he's talked about this stuff.
He was saying the loud part quiet and the quiet part loud, basically. And I think that certainly with Ryan, you know, Paul Ryan and many other representatives who had to warm up to Trump, clearly in their very embrace of him, are signaling that they don't really care about the racism aspects. But even from the get-go, I mean, they'd been enthusiastic about lots of immigration measures and policies that, I mean, some of which are already happening, as I'm sure you guys have pointed out. You know, mass deportations happened under Obama, millions of people deported under Obama, and that it was really Trump's style that turned them off. But I kind of want to talk about the Paulson thing, because His opening is typical of the Never Trump stuff. He says, "This troubles me deeply as a Republican, but even more as an American." And he's trying to, of course, signal that he's a good guy. You know, he's going to put his country over his party. And most people, including people, you know, center left or in the enlightened sort of liberal category, can all agree that, you know, who could possibly vote for this guy? He's just such a clearly loose cannon. And, oh, by the way, his business acumen isn't all that it could be. And the Democrats have called him poor Donald. And I think the Economist the other day sort of ridiculed him in an editorial calling him poor Donald. So it's kind of an odd tack to take if you're a Democrat and you're supposed to be in the party of, you know, the working class and indeed the poor. But that's how we've been seeing things play out. Paulson explicitly says here, at the end he talks about the environment. I think you read that bit about how it's our economy, our environment, and something else. He doesn't have a bit here in the environment. That's just like a line at the very end. The two main pieces of the op-ed discuss how it is, quote, appalling that Trump will not face up to the entitlement crisis and cut. He explicitly calls for cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And then in the second half, he talks about how Trump is, you know, shying or wants America to shy away from the international global economy, and that's wrong, and we can't turn back the clock, blah, 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 and that whole thing. So those are the two things he's telling us. He's not even pretending to care about this other stuff. Those are the things he's really mad about Trump for. And what's interesting to me, at least, is that he's endorsing Clinton. But Clinton formally, and again, we don't, I'm saying formally, she may reverse her public positions on these things, but formally she opposes the TPP now and is not terribly adamant about cutting the welfare state. I mean, again, she may end up doing that, but she's not publicly advocating any of the things that Paulson has apparently taken it upon himself to endorse her for. Or not endorse Trump.
Should that raise red flags among Clinton supporters when we have elite people who were responsible for the 2008 financial crisis and have been responsible for a lot of the problematic neoliberal policies we've seen over the last 30 years coming out and endorsing or at least trusting that Clinton is going to be on their side if she's elected the White House? Not only that, we have the Kagans, we have mm-hmm. The neoconservatives who orchestrated war in the Bush administration.
We also have Tom Nichols, Max Boot, neocons. They've backed
Michael Hayden, the CIA, former CIA NSA director. I mean, at what point do Clinton supporters look around and see who's marching alongside of them and be like, are we on the right team here?
That's got to be disturbing. And I think that the most generous argument you could probably muster for accepting these people is saying, well, look, I mean, That Churchill quote about Hitler, that he'd even partner with the devil, a.k.a. Stalin, to defeat Hitler. You know, there's this enemy of the enemy is my friend motif that you hear a lot. But I think you guys raise a pretty good question that, I mean, we're talking about people who the Clintons, and particularly the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party, now Hillary Clinton, are clearly on professional terms with. She is certainly, you know, known to Hank Paulson. She will probably be having conversations with Hank Paulson. She probably had a conversation with him before he wrote this op-ed, given that they're in the same, as you say, elite stratosphere of American politics. And you've got to imagine that these guys aren't just, they could stay home. They could say, oh, I don't want to vote for Trump. I don't endorse Trump, but I don't want to talk about Hillary Clinton either. Get her out of my mentions. But in fact, they seem to be actively identifying with the principles and the potential policy outcomes of a Clinton presidency. And as you outline, that ranges from foreign policy types who are pretty in favor of war, which actually Clinton is a lot more forthcoming about that. I mean, we don't know. She could, I'm no expert, she could be pushed into a more progressive domestic policy. And that, of course, remains to be seen. But she really hasn't made any bones about continuing to have a, I guess the word is muscular, foreign policy toward the rest of the world. And so the neocons obviously have no problem just identifying that and saying, that's awesome. We're happy to support her if that's the case. But Paulson, as you point out, is sort of, it seems like, yeah, he's banking on her coming around to these positions of explicitly, again, cutting the welfare state and expanding the free trade philosophy that underpinned the TPP.
And most years, you'd have to think that wouldn't really matter because U.S. politics are such an abysmal chasm of despair. But this year, we had a very serious progressive challenge in the Democratic primary. So this kind of, you know, raises questions after months and months and months of Clinton and her supporters being like, you know, she's a progressive. She's just a pragmatic progressive. Well, okay, now Hank Paulson seems to think so, too. So it's a little awkward.
There's been a lot of chatter about this. And one perspective that I think is actually pretty persuasive and we could probably all just hunker down and wait for. But when Hillary Clinton does get into office, should she win the presidency, there is an argument that unlike a Trump presidency, which would unite both the center left and the left in opposition to the myriad bad things that they think he would end up doing, a Clinton presidency would actually be quite a constructive and productive time for the left to point out to all the liberals or center left people or Democrats who voted for Hillary that, yeah, you really should have thought twice, you know, you really should have maybe considered that Bernie Sanders wasn't offering pie in the sky ideals and that Clinton was the one who was going to fulfill the progressive agenda in a much more, whatever, pragmatic way. There's going to be a lot of people who vote for her begrudgingly, and there's going to be a lot of people who vote for her pragmatically. And if she doesn't deliver, and this isn't if, she may, if she doesn't deliver on really the majority of what they were hoping she promised she would against Bernie's promises, then she may not see a second term, or there may be a very, very, you know, animated push to return to what Sanders ignited this election. And so the Paulson endorsements are a little ominous for those Clinton supporters who think that she will prove all these people wrong.
Well, Paulson's probably just looking at what Obama did. And it was President Obama who put cuts to Social Security on the table a few years ago and would have gotten that chain CPI passed had Republicans gone along with it. They're the ones who killed that deal, John Boehner and the Tea Parties, because it didn't go far enough. But it was Obama who actually was the first one to put those cuts on the table.
That's true. It was recently listening to a podcast your listeners may or may not be familiar with called Chapo Trap House, in which this was discussed. It was really a bunch of uncompromising right-wing members of Congress who saved what little is left of the American social safety net. And that's what I'm sure a lot of people want on the left from an Obama presidency.
Thank God for Louie Gohmert.
Thank God for Chuck Truckley and similar, you know, representatives, because you're right. And the grand bargain mentality is definitely all over this Paulson op-ed. And he says he yearns now for a bipartisan approach to policy solutions that addressed our most difficult domestic problems. That requires a president who exhibits the ability to compromise and basic civility, neither of which Trump displays. So Trump's incivility is a problem only insofar as he's not willing to get down with the bipartisan consensus.
and he's got potty mouth, as you said.
Yes.
Another thing about, you know, the possibility of getting a progressive Hillary Clinton administration, but don't bet the farm on it, is that she is at least nominally, you know, she has more constituents on the left, obviously, like SEIU endorsed Hillary, but obviously SEIU had endorsed Obama, and that didn't really stop him from proposing chain CPI, did it? So.
Well, we're going to get card check here at the end of the year, I'm sure.
Well, I just wanted to read one little thing about this whole Trump Paulson bit, because, you know, I really like this aspect of the story. This is a hat tip to a BuzzFeed Andrew, Andrew Kaczynski. Trump reacted to the endorsement by saying he didn't know anything about Paulson, but in 2008, he praised the Treasury Secretary performance amid the financial crisis. I would give him an A, he told CNN's Wolf Blitzer. The fact is he came into a mess, he didn't create the mess, and he is helping us get out of the mess. And by the way, later on in the interview, Wolf Blitzer asked him if then-Senator Obama should keep Paulson on. This is what Trump had to say. He has got his own people, and he has got his some very, very smart people with him, and he was referring to Obama. But hasn't he been saying Obama is very stupid and very incompetent for the past few years? I mean, should this matter? What matters anymore, Brendan? What matters?
Post-truth.
I have nothing to contribute to that cosmic question, but yeah, that's what Trump tends to say whenever someone, whenever a snake bites him. He said, "Oh, I never even heard of that guy," and it's, you know, he pretty much gets away with it, so he'll get away with it this time.
Brendan, we've got just less than a minute to go. I had made a prediction earlier that all these never Trumpers are going to eventually fall in line once the general election starts and end up supporting Trump. How committed are people like George Will and Paulson? Is there room for them to go back, or do they just basically have to protect their own pride at this point and just keep with the never Trump shtick?
I've heard some rumblings, and to be honest, I'm not sure to what degree. I don't have a scoop here, but I've heard, you know, that even David Petraeus, and I do think this was in an article recently, David Petraeus, you know, a darling of D.C., but obviously particularly of Republicans, that even he's looking to maybe take a bit of a, you know, a leap over to the Democratic side of D.C.
Yet another hawk on the side here.
Right. Oh, yeah. And because ultimately what matters is the career and the prestige and stuff like that. So I think that with some guys like Paulson, they're going to stick it out. I don't think they'll go for Trump. I think they'll just become cozier with Democrats.
I think you're probably right. I was probably wrong with that prediction. Brendan James, you can catch out his work over at the International Business Times and follow him on Twitter at @deep_beige. Thanks so much for coming on. More Unanimous Dissent coming up. Welcome back to Unanimous Dissent, still broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. You can't see it, but I am dancing in my chair, or I was, till the music stopped.
Yes, it was quite a dance. You know what? I kind of want to discuss some top secret content. What do you say we go into a classified session?
We need to get into classified session.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary.
We will. Post haste. If there's one member of the Senate that the national security establishment in the United States hates more than anyone, it's Ron Wyden, the Democratic senator from Oregon. Wyden was the guy who, back in 2013, pressed the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, on whether or not the NSA was conducting mass domestic espionage, which prompted Clapper to lie.
Does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir.
It does not.
Not wittingly.
If you watch the video, you'll see Clapper scratch his head as he says not wittingly. Classic tell.
Yeah.
Anyways, it was that lie that you heard right there, the no, not wittingly, that prompted Edward Snowden, a contractor at the NSA, to spill the beans a few months later to journalists that the NSA was indeed conducting a domestic dragnet. Well, Wyden is once again in the news this week, standing athwart the FBI and spy hawks in the Senate, telling them to stop. On Monday, he placed a hold on an intelligence policy bill that contains a measure that would allow the FBI to collect more of your online metadata using a national security letter. National security letters are specialized subpoenas that don't need probable cause of a crime, and they often gag their recipients from even talking about the order once it's been received. Well, here was Wyden speaking on the Senate floor about his opposition to the provision this week, which, if passed, could allow the feds to scoop up your internet browsing history, email transactional records, IP addresses, billing information, and so on.
Now, the reality is web browsing history can reveal an awful lot of information about Americans. I know of little information, frankly, Mr. President, that could be more intimate than that web browsing history. If you know that a person is visiting the website of a mental health professional or a substance abuse support group or a particular political organization or, say, a particular dating site, you know a tremendous amount. The reality is getting access to somebody's web browsing history is almost like spying on their thoughts. This level of surveillance absolutely ought to come with court oversight.
Wyden went on to note how these proposals to expand surveillance always seem to come about after a national tragedy, like the mass shooting in Orlando earlier this month.
American people want policies that protect their security and their liberty. They want policies that do both. Well, after a tragedy, and you can almost set your clock by it, increasingly proposals are being brought up that really don't do much of either.
So Wyden has a hold on the Intel policy bill for the reasons you just heard him mention himself. Now, in order to break this hold, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is going to need to get 60 votes from senators to invoke cloture on the bill. Whether he can or not is still up in the air. But what bodes well for the spy hawks is that last week, senators voted on an amendment to a Justice Department spending bill that would have similarly expanded national security letters' reach to include online metadata. That amendment failed by two votes, but one of those two votes was McConnell himself, who switched his vote from yay to nay in order to take advantage of Senate rules that would allow him to bring the bill back up for consideration when he sees fit. Another one of those two votes that could have helped put the amendment over the top was Senator Dianne Feinstein. She missed the vote. She missed the proceedings, but she would have likely supported the measure given her unwavering defense of the NSA and the national security state, except for the CIA. She's been pretty tough on the CIA lately. I think she just has a huge feud with John Brennan, and I don't blame her for that. The measure passed by failed by two votes, but if McConnell doesn't switch his vote and if Dianne Feinstein votes for it, it will pass. So I have a feeling that Senator Ron Wyden won't be able to put a stop to it by himself. And if you care about this issue, now is the time to call your senator. Also, it's not just this. There are multiple avenues that this spy proposal is currently working through. There's another bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. It's the Senate's version of the Email Privacy Act, which would update 30-year-old electronic privacy law to make sure that the government has to get a warrant before they read your old emails. Well, this legislation passed the House unanimously. It's now in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Senator John Cornyn from Texas is trying to attach this national security letter amendment to it, effectively stopping the bill in its tracks in committee. So, like I said, now's the time to call your senator and tell them no more expansion of FBI surveillance powers if you care about this issue. What do you think, Sam? Can we close out this session?
Actually, no. I have one more matter to discuss here.
Okay. Without objection?
I would like to enter into the record. No, I'm kidding. The U.S. Special Envoy for the Counter-Islamic State Coalition testified before a Senate committee earlier this week. Brett McGurk, who has a pretty ridiculous name. I just like to clear the air on that. Brett McGurk said Tuesday that U.S.-backed forces could soon be turning their attention to Raqqa, the de facto ISIL capital. McGurk said a precondition to that is the success of the ongoing assault on Manbij, apologies if I'm not pronouncing that right, a town in northeastern Syria entered by the coalition last week for the first time, and the last ISIL had territory on the Turkish-Syrian border. McGurk also noted that the forces involved in the Manbij operation are majority Arab for the first time, a result of special ops recruiting, he claimed. The distinction matters because Raqqa is a Sunni Arab city. Earlier this year in March, the head of U.S. Special Ops said U.S.-backed forces were roughly 80% Kurdish. Pressed about when he expected the U.S. to take Raqqa, McGurk said he hoped it would happen sooner than 14 months from now. He was asked about that date specifically by Wisconsin Republican Ron Johnson, because 14 months from now, it will be 3 years since the counter-ISIL war started. President Obama said it would take 3 years when he launched the war in 2014. Complicating the matters, however, Syrian government forces are also trying to take ISIL-held territory outside Raqqa with Russian air support, roughly 30 miles west of the city.
This is going to get really nasty. I mean, people don't realize really when we say that Raqqa is the de facto capital of the Islamic State, it's not like it's just filled with all Islamic State fighters.
Right,
it's a major population center filled with innocent people, and that the Islamic State is sort of embedded its capital among this population.
Right, right.
Which is why it's pretty bad when policymakers like Hillary Clinton and on the Republicans ask for President Obama to intensify airstrikes in places like Raqqa.
Yeah.
That is going to lead to more civilian casualties.
Yeah. And, as we know, from a military standpoint, there's only so much airstrikes can do. Yeah. It even feels weird saying that, obviously, because, a lot of times we talk about these military campaigns in a very detached sort of way. Yeah. The situation there is going to get pretty grim.
What's the latest on peace talks?
They are actually, mercifully, they might resume this week after a UN Security Council meeting on Wednesday. They'd broken down in April after the opposition left talks. It had accused the Syrian government of negotiating in bad faith. So hopefully, peace talks will get kickstarted again this week.
Yeah, just to kind of compound this mess, as we talked about on the show yesterday, there was a report over the weekend that showed that the Obama administration since 2013 had been funneling millions of dollars of weapons to Syrian rebels on the front lines. Yet those weapons were being stolen by Jordanian intelligence operatives and put up for sale on the black market. This is just a messy situation over there. Now time for some news for the 99%.
After Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died, so too did conservatives' hopes of walloping labor unions this year with a legal assault on their finances. In January, the Supreme Court had heard Friedrichs v. California Teachers Association, and it didn't look like justices would rule in favor of the unions. But it turns out that Father Time had different plans in February when Scalia suddenly died.
This is like our third episode ever, and I think in every episode we've made it a point to remind our audience that Scalia is dead.
I think we have, but because his death continues to
loom
large over us.
And including this case.
Yes. After Scalia passed, with only 8 justices on the bench and without the staunch right-winger, the court was split 4-4. The tie meant the law was upheld due to a previous appellate court ruling. Well, while there is practically no hope of reviving Scalia, barring a zombie apocalypse, some sort of Pentagon un-death ray, or perhaps a Weekend at Bernie's style scenario, the Friedrichs plaintiffs had one last shot at revival in the form of a rehearing petition they had filed in April. Specifically pointing to the shorthanded court, they said the following: "The questions presented in this case are too important to leave unsettled with an affirmative by an equally divided court, and they're guaranteed to recur in the absence of a definitive ruling from this court. Petitioners thus respectfully request that the court rehear this case after it obtains a full complement of justices capable of reaching resolution by a 5-justice majority." Now, to get that hearing, they needed a 5-justice majority, which they didn't get. Monday, the court announced that they would not accept the rehearing petition. It was killed. And with that, finally, the assault on unions that died with Scalia also died again, or, died for good. It was one of those zombie movies where the zombie keeps coming back.
You got to cut its head off.
So now just some background about the case to illustrate how damning it could have been. The matter in dispute was public sector agency fees. Basically, these are rules that require non-union members to pay for their share of collective bargaining since they also benefit from it. 7.2 million union members in this country work in the public sector, and that is almost half of the union member, half of the union membership in this country. So because of the timing of Antonin Scalia's death, organizations directly representing about half of the labor union members in this country got a reprieve, one that was finalized this week.
So this basically gets down to the free rider problem, that if you have a group of, for example, unionized teachers or whatever, and states want to pass laws that say, look, if you don't want to be in a union, you shouldn't have to be in a union and you shouldn't have to pay union dues. So they would allow certain teachers to opt out of paying union dues and not be in the union. But those teachers will still get all the benefits of that union. And there's multiple stats that show that unionized workers make more money, have better benefits, and face less risk at the workplace than non-unionized workers.
You know, when you say union fees, it's specifically collective bargaining fees, because there are already, you know, exemptions for people who don't want to directly join the union. But you're absolutely correct. Bureau of Labor Statistics data shows that union members and workers who are, quote, represented by unions, aka, you know, non-members who fall under CBAs, they make roughly the same amount in both the private and public sector. Meanwhile, non-union workers make considerably less, about 20% less in the private sector and 10% less in the public sector.
And unions, of course, are politically active, primarily in the Democratic Party.
That's right.
They're sort of the counterbalance to corporate money that traditionally flowed toward Republicans, but also flows toward a lot of Democrats nowadays, which is why Republicans are so dead set in favor of passing laws like this, because it would deny unions of necessary revenue that they could then use for future organizing or even political purposes.
Or collective bargaining. And of course, you know, unions can't nearly match the muscle that all the corporate donors have. But, you know, you're right that this is sort of a solid stream of revenue, not just, you know, for collective bargaining and union activity. But as you said, the Democratic Party gets a lot of support from unions, too.
Well, we're running out of time for our show today, so let's go to Devil's Advocate.
I agree with you, Bart.
What about both sides?
Well, you're only technically right.
Devil's Advocate.
All right. By now, you should know the drill, folks. In this segment, one of us takes a position that is obviously bad. It's a very bad position, but they try to argue that it is actually quite good. For today's show, we tackle the wisdom of the House Republican Select Committee on Benghazi, which released an 800-page report on Tuesday, basically clearing Clinton and the Obama administration of any wrongdoing on the night that four Americans were killed at the U.S. consulate in Libya. Sure, the committee spent $7 million on an investigation that had already been carried out by a number of other committees, and sure, nothing all that new was turned up by the committee related to Benghazi. But I'm going to argue that this whole exercise was actually good. Here's why. Clearly, with so much interest in how four Americans were killed in Libya, Congress will have to move forward with finding out how more than 4,000 Americans were killed in the Iraq War, right? This committee obviously is just paving the way to holding the Bush administration accountable for their illegal war. Am I right?
Yeah, maybe.
You buying into that?
Yeah, sure. Let's go with it.
All right, well, I guess I don't need to convince you any further, but in case you were still on the fence here, without the Benghazi committee, we wouldn't have had the Benghazi movie. I think it's called 13 Hours or something, which stimulated John Krasinski's acting career. The guy went from Jim Halpert on The Office for a while, then not much, and he couldn't shade that nice guy image. Now he's a big buff Marine, defying the stand-down orders.
I was baiting you there because you're wrong about both these things. Here's why the Benghazi committee was good, right? Number one, it helped further the hashtag Benghazi joke on Twitter and the Benghazi acrostic joke.
Which you've made a lot of money from, I can say. Not money, but...
Right, like money, yeah, make money with those
Twitter dollars, Twitter bucks.
Stacking those retweets, yeah. Number two, it created the joke about Trey Gowdy having a ridiculous haircut because people got to know who Trey Gowdy was. He has a ridiculous haircut. He looks like an almond.
Yes, and we might not have known about his coif if this committee never came into existence. I think we're just going to have to end it there.
Let's do it.
The committee was good because of Trey Gowdy's hair. That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by checking out the Radio Sputnik website or by going to Spreaker and searching for Unanimous Dissent. You can also listen to the shows via our website and check out what Sam and I are doing over there at our day job reporting political news. Check the website at www.districtsentinel.com. We'll see you tomorrow. We're staying here in D.C., so you don't have to be.